hear me, Mother? Well, the reading is actually from John chapter 2. And if you've got a church Bible, we're going to be reading it from page 118. So that's John chapter 2, page 118. And we're just going to be reading the first 11 verses. Two days later, there was a wedding in the town of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine had given out, Jesus' mother said to him, "They've no wine left." "You must not tell me what to do," Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." Jesus' mother then told the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." The Jews have rules about ritual washing, and for this purpose, 6 stone water jars were there, each one large enough to hold about 100 liters. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill these jars with water." They filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw some water out and take it to the man in charge of the feast." They took in the water, which had now turned into wine, and he tasted it. He did not know where this wine had come from, but of course the servants who had drawn out the water knew. So he called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the best wine first. After the guests have plenty to drink, he serves the ordinary wine. But you have kept the best wine until now." Jesus performed this first miracle in Cana in Galilee. There he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. If we could have the PowerPoint up, I think that would be great. So we're going to look at the first sign. There are 7 signs. We're going to be thinking about that a little later. But this is the first sign which is recorded in John for us. And I called it, "Behold, I make all things new," the new wine of the kingdom. But I thought, before looking at this, we'll begin with a story. And we can have the next one up, Akin. Actually, let's see if this works. Yes. On December the 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks, who was 40 years old and an African-American woman, worked as a seamstress. And she was going back home. She had a long day. She boarded a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And her family were all members of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. She was quite a respectable lady. And she sat in the middle of the bus, just behind the 10 seats that were reserved for whites. The first 4 rows of seats on each Montgomery bus were reserved only for whites. And buses had coloured sections for black people who had to sit in the rest of the bus. The sections were not fixed, but they were determined by the placement of a movable sign. And black people could sit in the middle of the bus until a white person came and needed the seat. And the blacks had to move from their seat to the back of the bus. And black people could not sit across the aisle in the same row as white people. On this particular bus, on this particular day, all the seats of the bus were filled. And a white person came in, and the driver insisted that the 4 blacks sitting just behind the white section give up their seats so the man could sit down. 3 of them moved, but Rosa quietly refused to give up her seat. And the driver, a man called James Blake, insisted. Rosa said, "If I was going to stand up..." Sorry, he asked if she was going to stand up. He said, "No, I'm not." And he said, "Well, if you don't stand up, I'm going to call the police and have you arrested. And Rosa simply said, you may do that. And she said that people always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired. She'd had a long day. But that wasn't the reason. The reason I didn't get up was because I was tired, but it was more the fact that I was tired of being told what to do. I was tired of giving in. So she sat down and remained sitting down. When Rosa refused to give up her seat, the police arrested her. The officer took her away. And she asked, why do you push us around? And he said, I don't know. But the law's the law, and you're under arrest. She was arrested and convicted of violating the laws of segregation. And this was under the Jim Crow legislation. And there was a whole range of customs and laws about segregation. And although it was relatively easy to keep the races apart in most areas of life, it was much harder on transportation, because people who use bus and trains couldn't afford cars, either white or black, and so they had to occupy the same space. What happened was people started a boycott of the Montgomery bus system. In cities across the South, the segregated companies were boycotted. And the boycott in Montgomery went on for 381 days. And people walked to work through rain, through shine. Although it was a non-violent process, churches were bombed, there were burning crosses in the streets, the Ku Klux Klan, that was a white supremacist organisation, attacked people, but people still boycotted the bus. Eventually, the authorities gave in. They repealed the law requiring segregation on public buses, but only because it was following a Supreme Court ruling that it was unconstitutional. But it was a sign that the old was going and the new was coming. And Rosa, not getting up out of her seat, was an action which in a sense was prophetic. It was symbolic for what it revealed about the old and its acceptance of rules and obligations. And her action sparked a challenge about things that needed to change, of new things. It signified and symbolized the possibility of a different reality, and that the common sense assumptions of that day needed to be challenged, and the rules of segregation and what lay behind them were wrong. And the talk this morning looks at another incident which was actually very humble, like this incident on the bus. It happened in Cana, which in Galilee, which was a very ordinary sort of place, a bit like Montgomery, Alabama. It was a one-horse town where the horse left a long time ago. And archaeologists are actually struggling to find out where Cana was, and there are at least four possible sites. But fortunately, the Israeli Tourist Board is ahead of us, and they've identified Kafna in Cana as the place where this took place. And they're not the only ones. The Franciscans agree with them in the 13th century, and they've built a wedding church there in Cana of Galilee. So this is Cana, drawn from a print in 1923. And if you go there today, that's what it looks like today, much like any other Israeli town. It's about 18,000 people. And not much different from anywhere else. It's captured the imagination through the centuries. This is a painting by Giotto. It marks a very significant change in Western art. As you can see, it's full of realism and detail, but it captured the Christian imagination of what happened in Cana in Galilee. This is Gustave Doré. He's the French illustrator. He did a lot of the illustrations for Poverty in London, and this is his take, a bit more realistic, of the wedding in Cana of Galilee. And actually, we'll leave that up. This is significant, this incident in Cana, because it's the first of seven signs. Now, if you've been here over the last few weeks, you know that we've been journeying through Revelation, and the number seven has been coming up an awful lot. And you will know that it's used as the sign of completion. And John organizes his gospel very tightly on the basis of seven. And in the first 12 chapters of the Bible, or sorry, in John, are these seven signs. And with these seven signs, there are also seven conversations or discourses. But these are the seven. And as you can see, the first two happen in this hick town called Cana in Galilee, which is the water into wine. And then a little bit later, Jesus comes back and heals the official's son. And the two central sections in the book are about where Jesus reveals his glory. And the second section is about where the passion reveals who Jesus is in greater detail. Now, when Jesus came, there was some expectation of who the Messiah was and of the future hope of the nation. He was generally known as the Anointed One. And he was expected to establish an eternal throne, a King Messiah from the line of David. So Jeremiah writes, "When the day comes, I will break the yoke that is around their necks and remove their chains, and they will no longer be slaves of foreigners. Instead, they will serve me, the Lord their God, and the descendant of David I will enthrone as king." So they were expecting the Messiah as king. They were also expecting him as a prophet in Jeremiah and in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy it says, "He," that is God, "will send you a prophet like me," that's Moses, "from among your people, and you will obey. And I will tell him what to say, and he will tell the people everything I command." And this expectation was picked up by the feeding of the people at the feeding of the 5,000. And the crowd anticipated this, that this is the prophet that has come. And they wanted to take Jesus by force and make him king. But there's also the expectation that the Messiah was to be a priest. From Psalm 110, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." And from Zechariah, it is, "He who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty and rule on his throne." They were expecting new things of this Messiah. And Jesus fulfilled all these roles that they expected. And John records in one of his arguments with the Pharisees, these signs that were being argued about, "If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me." The Jews had also failed to understand that the Messiahship included a lot of other things as well. The suffering servant of ministry, of rejection and suffering, rather than royalty and conquest. But other roles, such as the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Word, the Saviour, which enriched and deepened and expanded the interpretation of the Old Testament prophetic traditions. So the Messiah was more than a prophet, more than a priest, more than a king. But he was, in his ministry, a prophet. He, like other prophets, he used symbols and actions to determine the message, to dramatize the message, sorry, to signify and reveal, and taking the things from the ordinary world and sometimes embodying those actions within themselves to speak of greater things. And the plot of this gospel is very tight. It is tied to the purpose of God in this crucial redemptive event, which would lead to the death, resurrection, and exaltation of Jesus. And he's given other titles as the Lamb of God and I Am. And he's particularly the relationship of Jesus to the Father, which is significantly new and is very different. He is subordinate in that he does these things the Father gives him to say and do. He does everything the Father does, since the Father shows him everything he himself does. So he is more than a prophet from David's line. He is indeed the Son of God. And Jesus uses, John uses the word signs in his passage in the Gospels. And these signs are a new messianic age where the new wine flows freely. It's a symbol of the consummation of this messianic age that the Jews were expecting but not really understanding. And these seven signs anticipate the glory of Jesus as the messianic bridegroom. So let's turn to the passage itself. And it's 2 days after he met with Nathanael, who was also from Cana in Galilee. And Cana is also mentioned again, and Nathanael is mentioned also again right at the end of the Gospel. He's part of the fishing party with Simon Peter. And the wedding takes place in this fairly nondescript place, and most weddings, according to the Mishnah, took place on a Wednesday. And the bride and the groom would, the bride would go to the groom would go to the bride's house in procession. It would often be at night, it would be torch lit, and there would be some ceremonies, and then they would go back to the groom's house, where there would be a party which would go on for a week. And it was open house. And the rabbis had a saying that without wine, there is no joy. So joy was going to be in very short supply in this household because the wine had run out. And it's also true that the wine was a mixture of two parts wine and three parts water. But even so, it had run out. And it was in a humble village. And the Galilean woman that was being married, the girl, the ordinary person, was obviously come from quite a poor background. And it was going to be a disaster. Not just because a catering disaster, but the person, the groom who was responsible for running the feast, could be legally liable for the fact that it ran out. And Jesus arrives with these five new disciples and his mother, and there is this domestic crisis. And Mary approaches him and says they have no wine left. It may well be that she was related to the person that was there, so that's why she felt able to take control of the situation as it developed. And Jesus says to her in the Good News Bible, you must not tell me what to do. And for reasons I don't really understand, the Good News Bible actually misses out the way that Jesus actually refers to his mother, as a woman. And it's a very courteous response, but it's also quite distant. And I think it was actually as a small rebuke to Mary that she was expecting her blood relationships, her mother relationships with him, to be able to get him to do things. But Jesus, in the start of his ministry, he came to do the will of God and his will alone. And he wasn't going to allow people through friendship, through family, to actually get him to do things which went beyond his Father's will. But nonetheless, as in other instances, that where he initially refuses to respond, he responds. And I think it's Mary's faith here that she just trusted him that he would know what to do. She didn't know what was coming next. She knew there was a problem. I'm not sure she was expecting a miracle, but she trusted him, and she said to the servants to do what he said. So, having shrugged off this gentle rebuke, she displays her faith by asking the servants to do what he says. Now, these purification jars were big. They were made of stone rather than earthenware because they were used for these rituals of purification. And there was a whole developed system of rules and regulations around purification so that you were able to enjoy the feast. So you would have your feet washed a certain way. You would have your hands washed a certain way. You would have to wash the utensils. You would have to have a wash between courses. It was a very involved process. And these utensils and this water represents the old order of Jewish law and custom. And it was about to replace with something better. And it was the sheer quality of the wine produced, which is lavishly symbolic of the provision of the new age that is breaking in. That the time of ceremonial purification had been fulfilled. It didn't need it to be used anymore. The apparatus was redundant. It had been superseded with all its rules and regulations. And what Jesus does in turning the water into wine is a symbol of what the law cannot supply. Jesus gives freely with fullness of joy to be drawn from the feast of the Messiah banquet, which has, in one sense, already begun. And this is really new. The old has gone, the new wine of the kingdom. And the guests know nothing of the crisis and the solution, and they just have an ordinary sense of the wine that is being served, that it's better than it was before. Normally people serve the good wine first, and when palates are ruined, they serve the plonk. But for the disciples, they knew differently. That in this everyday, ordinary action, Jesus' glory was revealed. It was a window into what was happening next. It was a sign and a symbol of the new age that is breaking in, that is making everything new. In a very ordinary, very run-down, very nondescript sort of place. And it was an act of great kindness as well. I've calculated roughly that there was about 1,500 bottles of wine, if you mix it with the water that was produced, if all the purification jars turned into wine. Now that's a lot of bottles to get from Tesco's. But what it also meant was this poor family that was obviously struggling because they didn't have enough for the wine for the whole of the feast, not only had a wedding gift, but they had an asset, like the lady that filled her jars full of oil miraculously that she might survive. And it was a sign and a symbol of how Jesus was going to supply all and every need. So I'm going to finish by just with this thought. We looked at the story of Rosa Parks to begin with, and it's a very ordinary story, a very mundane story. It was very unexciting, it was domestic. It was unremarkable. But something happened because of the fact that she didn't stand up. And what we're looking at in this unremarkable, nondescript town, in this very normal event, in this wedding, is also very remarkable. And it shows you that God often works on the sidelines, on the margins, that you have to be able to see through the eye of faith what God is actually doing. And most people, like the guests, like the servants, would have passed it by completely. But for the disciples, they glimpsed the glory of Jesus and they believed in him. They followed him. Now they believed in him. And I'm just wondering, as we go about our ordinary everyday things, because we sit on the bus, we eat, we work, we do lots of ordinary things. But it's maybe in the midst of those ordinary, mundane, everyday things that we do that Jesus is present in his kingdom. That if we have the faith and the sight and the insight to see, that if we take those small steps of expectant faith and obedience, much like Mary took, who didn't know what was going to happen next, but she expressed faith in that very small step of asking the servants to do what he tells you to do, that the kingdom breaks in. And that makes an exhilarating day, I think, because you never know what God can do.